Good morning, everyone. We're going to call the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee meeting to order now that we have a quorum. I hope everyone had a good day since the last time we met. I know we have a couple set of minutes to approve. Representative Anderson, would you move the minutes from March 10th, 2016? Representative Anderson moves the minutes from March 10th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the minutes from March 10th, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Minutes from March 10th are adopted. Representative Anderson, would you make a motion on yesterday's minutes from March 15th? Representative Anderson moves the minutes from March 15th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the minutes from March 15th, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Minutes from March 15th are adopted. All right, we are going to jump just a little bit on the agenda, just so everyone in the room understands. We're going to take up House File 2735 last on the agenda, and we're going to start with House File 2572 today, Representative Zerwas. Welcome to the committee, Representative Zerwas.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members.
I have a note here that says this House file should be going to public safety. Is that correct?
I believe so.
Okay, with that, I will move House File 2572 to be referred to public safety. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have an A1 amendment. Mr. Chairman, if you could move the A1 amendment. It's a definition for children's advocacy centers. That was a concern that was raised in the previous committee.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. I will move the A1 amendment, which is an author's amendment, to put the bill in the shape the author desires. Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 2572 is a bill for child advocacy centers. Across the state, we've expanded child advocacy centers to be involved in investigations around child protection, child abuse, and child sexual abuse. There's a lot of collaboration and cross-information to create a collaborative work team to work with the families of the victims of these types of investigations and these types of instances. And to more thoroughly get that done, it was expanded across the state. We had a county in northern Minnesota that had a slight concern because child advocacy centers themselves weren't specifically stated in the statute that we were using for these groups to work together and collaborate. Although in previous years, Hennepin County, Ramsey County, Anoka County had no concern. As this program was expanded after an appropriation in the previous session, there was a county that raised concerns. And so we're back just so everyone's comfortable that child advocacy centers fit under this arrangement and we can have a shared collaboration for these members of a really important collaborative to help these families out. I do have one testifier, a brief testifier, who will explain a little bit more of the mission of what we're accomplishing with child advocacy centers.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Welcome to the committee. If you would just introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning. My name is Marcia Milliken. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Children's Alliance. We're a coalition that represents children's advocacy centers and multidisciplinary teams. We currently have 7 established children's advocacy centers in Minnesota, and last year an appropriation was passed of $400,000 a year that allows us to expand children's advocacy centers, and currently we have 4 more developing across Minnesota in just this year. We are a multidisciplinary team organization that investigates cases of child sex abuse, serious physical abuse. We also work with victims of trafficking, and it's not only for children, it's for youth and for vulnerable adults. Our children's advocacy centers work with law enforcement, child protection, prosecution, medical and mental health, as well as victim advocacy. And one of the core components of our system is to do case review, which pertains to the statute. During case review, we meet monthly. The partner organizations meet monthly to talk about the case, to make sure that children don't fall through the cracks, to make sure that we're doing everything we can to provide the wraparound services that are needed for the kids. And by adding children's advocacy centers to the statute, we can guarantee that that each county interprets this consistently.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Rumbeck, a question for the testifier.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, are you organized under the courts or under the counties, or what sort of what authority branch do you work from?
We are nonprofit.
Ms. Milliken?
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are organized. We are nonprofit organizations by and large. We are separate. We are not county entities. We are not governmental entities. We have, some are organized under hospitals, some are nonprofit organizations. We were developed originally in the mid-80s in response to a need for children to not be interviewed multiple times. And so this is an organizational structure so that instead of kids having to be going from professional to professional to professional to be interviewed, the professionals come to the child. So it's a collaborative among professional agencies.
Follow-up, Representative Rumbeck.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Are you invited then into a particular situation, and that's how you would be? Are you at the center of it then, and people are hoping that you're going to do the mediation and bring people together? I guess I'm just wanting to understand more.
Ms. Milliken.
Thank you. We receive our referrals from child protection or law enforcement after a report is made, and then we serve as the structure that brings that team together, and we ensure that the team works together to conduct forensic interviews, specialized medical exams. We ensure that children are referred for trauma-focused mental health services, and we make sure that families and children receive the support and advocacy that they need as they go through the system. So we provide that structure in which the multidisciplinary team works.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Chair Sanders. This is for the testifier, Representative Zerwas. I'm familiar with Corner House in the West Metro. Would they fit this definition because they do the forensic interviews and even train others to do them?
Ms. Milliken?
Thank you. Yes, Corner House is a child advocacy center.
Thank you.
Any other member questions or discussion for the testifier? Seeing none, is there any further questions or discussion to this House File 2572? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 2572 be referred to public safety as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is approved. House File 2572 is on its way to public safety. Thank you, Representative Zerwas. We'll go to your next bill on the agenda, House File 2718. And I will make a motion that House File 2718 be referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2718 is a bill dealing with the Elk River Municipal Utilities located within Elk River and a little bit in the surrounding communities. We have currently a three-member Elk River Municipal Utility Public Utility Board, and because of certain growth in recent years and acquisition of additional service area, the business of the Elk River Municipal Utilities is growing and certainly not comparable to 100 years ago when the structure was first created. And so like many municipal utilities have in recent years, we're interested in transforming from a three-member public board to a five-member board, and we need statutory statutory authority to do that. I'm here to testify briefly about the utilities. General Manager of the Elk River Municipal Utilities, Troy.
Hey, good morning, sir. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Troy Adams. I'm the General Manager of Elk River Municipal Utilities. We're in our 100th year serving the community of Elk River and the surrounding areas. Probably within the last decade was when we had our most significant growth, really the metro expanding out, and the growth of Maple Grove and Rogers really has moved into Sherburne County and Elk River. And in the last year, we actually had seen a 10% growth in customer count. And we've gone in the last 10 years from about a $30 million budget to a $40 million budget. Because of the size of the operation and the complexity, we've started to establish committees within the utility. Because of the limitations of having a three-member commission, we're limited to only having one member of the commission on a committee. Otherwise, we end up in a quorum. So because of that, and really to better represent our community, the Utilities Commission and the City Council were looking for approval to expand the commission to five.
Thank you, Mr. Adams, for your testimony. Members, any questions for the testifier? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Adams, or Representative Zerwas. I guess mine's a technical question here. Currently, the three-member board, you have one appointed every year or elected every year, and you have three-year terms. And then how are you going to do the mechanics of, with five members? Is it going to be two, two, and one, or how are you going to work that out?
Mr. Adams.
Yes, we would feather those in, and we would end up with a two, two, and one.
Okay. Just a strictly mechanical question. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
I think my question is answered. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Perfect. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a governance question. Representative Zerwas, is Elk River a statutory city?
Mr. Adams.
And the reason I ask that question is it says members of the council in a statutory city, your mayor would be a part of the city council. In a home charter, the mayor would be a separate executive office. And if it's a statutory city, my questions are answered. If it's not, then I have a few follow-ups.
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair, members, we are a statutory city.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good answer. Any other member questions? Seeing none, any final comments? Representative Zerwas.
Thank you for your help.
With that, members, I'll renew my motion that House File 2718 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. House File 2718 is on its way to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's see, House File 2820, Representative Fenton. Go ahead when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I make a motion to move House File 2820 to be heard and sent to the General Registry.
Representative Fenton moves House File 2820 to be referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, House File 2820 is somewhat similar to the bill we heard out of Ramsey County yesterday. But this bill is to streamline the HRA and the EDA into one agency to be named the Community Development Agency. So this agency will have a strong working relationship between the county and the municipalities, using shared resources to make a one-stop for businesses looking to locate within Washington County. This bill has full bipartisan support. Every member of the House that represents a portion of Washington County has signed on to it. And this is something that Washington County has worked very hard amongst themselves as well as with the municipalities to set in place. And you're going to be hearing today from County Commissioner Fran Miron, as well as the head of Washington County HRA Executive Director, Barbara Dacey. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to my testifiers.
Excellent. Welcome to the committee, both of you. If you would just introduce yourself before your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Fran Miron. I serve as a Washington County Commissioner in Washington County.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Barbara Dacey, the Executive Director of the Washington County HRA.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Washington County would like to take a more active role in economic development. We've been working collaboratively with our cities on this since the fall of 2013, and we have resolutions and of support from all of the cities that we've been into, that we've been working with. We would like to add value to the economic development efforts through countywide promotion, programming, and partnerships through our staff at the Housing and Redevelopment Authority. We want to promote the assets of the county. We'd like to work with cities and townships to offer programs that help retain businesses, provide for business expansion, and attract new businesses. And we'd like to strengthen our partnership with local businesses. Ultimately, the goal here is to retain the county's quality of life and expand its tax base and provide an opportunity for jobs and services within Washington County.
Mr. Chair and members, the proposed bill simply adds the economic development powers as outlined in Chapter 469 to the existing Housing and Redevelopment Authority. It does not create a second agency. We are taking the same path as Dakota, Carver, and Scott. And finally, the proposed bill keeps the existing the levy and the process in play. It does not add a second levy, but gives the county board the authority to levy up to either the HRA rate or the Economic Development Authority rate, whichever is higher, and that is determined by statute.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Representative Rumbeck.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. A question was asked yesterday about would there be any duplication? I mean, so the county and the city, who's the lead agency? How would you handle that? Because I think many cities probably have HRAs, CDAs, whatever.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Rumbeck, our effort here is to complement what's going on within our cities currently, and I've been before all of the EDAs within the cities that I represent in Washington County, and the EDAs, along with the cities, recognize our efforts as being a complement to the work that they're doing, not a duplication.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess to either one you want to answer, I guess. In the past, Minneapolis Public Housing was part of the Minneapolis Community Development Agency. At some point, they split it into from a community development agency to a housing redevelopment, to an HRA and the development agency separate, because there was some concern out of Washington that HUD dollars are being used for development and not for the housing piece that they're supposed to go to. What steps are you going to take to make sure that that doesn't happen so that you don't get the wrath of Washington, D.C. come down upon you?
Ms. Dacey?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, the HUD-funded public housing and Section 8 programs are actually a very small part of our budget. So I do not anticipate that happening at all. We've put together a series of programs and initiatives that have funding from other sources as well as the local levy.
Okay. Representative Nelson, follow up? Good. Any other member questions for any of the testifiers? Any member questions, discussion, comments to the bill? Seeing none, any final comments from the table?
I just want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and the members of this committee. This has been, and I want to thank Washington County for working hard with all of the municipalities to take their input as we put this bill together. And I just make my motion again for House File 2820 to be referred to the General Registry.
Representative Fenton renews her motion that House File 2820 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 2820 is on its way to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Fenton.
Thank you.
Thank you to the testifiers. With that, we will now take up House File 2735.
We did, Chad.
Members and to members of the public, as you can see, we're about to hear a highly visible bill on today's schedule. We'll be hearing House File 2735 regarding presidential primary today on an information-only basis. So to Chairman Sanders, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we want to begin to start the conversation today on presidential primary, and right now what we are trying to do is work very closely with the Senate to make sure that we have a bill that lines up hopefully identically as we can move through the process to get the bill right the first time and to hopefully be able to move it through the process as quickly and smoothly as possible. So while we're still working on language, I think it's important enough that we begin to start the conversation, and then we'll come back on Tuesday and actually hopefully pass the House file regarding presidential primary. Let me start off by saying that our caucuses this year, the first Tuesday in March, was fantastic, spectacular. Turnout, interest, engagement from the public. I don't think anybody actually saw the amount of participation that we had. I don't think anyone really saw that coming, which is fantastic. But what we ran into was we weren't adequately prepared to handle the engagement from Minnesota citizens to participate in choosing who their nominee would be in their respective parties for President of the United States. And I want to thank Representative Garofalo for really kind of kickstarting the momentum on this idea and this conversation of moving to a presidential primary. Because I think it's very important that as we are looking at who the nominee should be for our respective parties, that everybody that wants to have a voice and is eligible to vote in Minnesota be able to have a say in who their party's nominee is. Minnesota already has some of the highest voter participation in the country. We take a lot of pride in that. We take pride in the civic engagement of our constituents. But we have to also be able to facilitate and be able to have the accessibility for our constituents and for voters in Minnesota to actually be able to vote. And I know that particularly in a lot of the suburban areas, I mean, people were parking blocks, if not a mile away from their caucus locations, trying to get to caucus in time to vote, to say who they wanted their choice to be for president. And in some cases, folks were turned away, which is something we don't ever want to see happen because they couldn't get to their polling place in time. They couldn't get into the room because it took them an hour and a half to park and walk to the room. That's something that we need to overcome. We had some confusion already in that folks thought we already had a presidential primary. We had reports of people showing up at polling places all during the day saying, when can I vote? Where do I vote? Not really understanding that you actually had to attend your caucus later that night, and sometime during that caucus time, you would be allowed to vote for president, for the presidential nominee. So right after that point in time, I think the conversation started immediately, and we really began to see that we needed to start taking some steps to really contemplate seriously moving to a presidential primary. So in working with a lot of the stakeholders, the party chairs, Secretary of State Simon, Representative Nelson, many other members on this committee, we decided to go ahead and draft legislation, and that's what House File 2735 is right now, is the plan to move to a presidential primary. And what would happen is this bill would take effect, and the first time this would happen would be on March 3rd, 2020, and it would actually move to a primary where just like any other election. Folks show up at their polling place during that day, and they're able to vote for their presidential nominee of their choice. So we think that this is very important. We think that opening up the accessibility and the facilities to allow this to happen, we particularly see that when there is an open seat for the office of president, that folks, that is when they really get energized. That is when they really feel like they have a voice. That is when the candidates and the campaigns are most active, and the participation is at its highest. But really, when choosing the leader of the free world and when choosing the president of the United States, folks want to have a say. They want Minnesota to matter. They want to be able to be engaged, and I think it's critical that we move on some legislation this session to begin to facilitate that, so that everybody feels like and everybody does have a voice in choosing their party's nominee for president of the United States. So with that, members, we can walk through the bill. We can begin questions. I know that, again, we're matching up language with the Senate, so there will be changes to this bill that's in front of us. I know that Secretary of State Simon is here as well to help field technical questions, or if you want to ask his opinion on the bill as well. We're happy to go through all of that now. So with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to the committee, and we'll let the discussion lead us where we go.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Chair. I guess the question I've got, and when looking at it, is in our discussions have come up, there's something I don't think we've talked about, but I think we've talked, when we add a presidential primary, we're going to add a cost to the local units of government that put the elections on, because the state doesn't do that. It's the counties and the cities and the townships that do that and pay for the cost. Have you thought about putting some sort of statutory funding in here so that it isn't at the whim of who's ever in charge of the legislature for 4 years from now or 3 years from now, and we set that budget for that year? Because there's going to be a cost, and we should be reimbursing the counties, otherwise we're adding another unfunded mandate onto them. Have you thought about doing that in the form of a statutory appropriation?
Chairman Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, I do agree with you, and that was a concern also brought up by a couple of my members as well. That I think we're going to go back and model some of the statutory language from 1992, where we actually did have a statutory reimbursement set up there. I am open to having language to where we would statutorily give the Secretary of State's office funding for them to reimburse the counties. In a presidential year, this would likely be their third election of the year, and I agree that is a large cost and a large operation that a lot of the counties would have to undertake. Also, with this only being once every 4 years, I believe that it is I believe it's very doable, and at that point the costs to the state are minimal, but we certainly should be willing to help the counties out.
And follow up, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Chair, I guess the other thought that comes to my mind here, we both live in the metro area, but I try to keep from my time with Representative Leader on the Transportation Committee, try and think about the whole state when we go forward on this. Township elections, some township elections are in March, and could this, are we being cognizant of that to make sure that we're not overlapping on them? Because in effect, if you're in a township, you'd have a presidential primary on March 3rd, which is my son's birthday, by the way, and then we'd have later on they'd have their township elections within a week or 2 weeks later. Are we looking at maybe allowing them to combine those, or just have this as the presidential primary standalone?
Chairman Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, I'm certainly open to that, but I'll tell you right now, as the language is drafted, what we do is, as a state, we set the date for the first Tuesday in March unless the parties agree on a different date. So it's much like caucus as of right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's where we set a date to say, hey, you know, MNGOP, MNDFL, if the two parties don't agree on the date, then it will be the first Tuesday in February or the first Tuesday in March this year. So the parties actually have more discretion. We just kind of set a finality in there to say, hey, this will be the date if you guys don't agree on a different date. So I'm certainly open to making sure that, you know, elections, whether in-state or out-state townships, are running as smoothly as possible, and we'll have to see how those line up. I mean, we certainly don't want to complicate things more than we have to, but I also believe that, you know, accessibility for all Minnesotans to be able to choose their presidential nominee is critical. So we'd like to find a way to make sure all that works out. But again, the state has its role to play, but the parties also have a role to play.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Chair, the other question, I think you touched this in your opening remarks, but this, I heard a report on the radio talking about our hearing this morning when I was driving in and they talked about this is going to get rid of the caucuses and replace the caucuses. And from my reading of the bill and from our discussions, this does not get rid of the caucuses. It's just the presidential preference vote that the two parties held this year as part of the caucuses will be to go to the presidential primary, and the caucuses will still be held by the various parties. Am I correct in that, sir?
Chairman Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, you are correct. This bill preserves the caucus system. We're not trying to eliminate caucuses. In fact, in speaking with Chairman Downey, who was also in talking with Chairman Ken Martin, I believe what they are hoping to do is have caucuses actually hopefully line up the week before the actual presidential primary election. Caucuses are important, especially for local party building, for the local candidates. All of us in this room, you know, would still receive our endorsements, you know, and work through the ranks as we normally do right now. So we want to preserve that caucus system. The primary, that would be the first Tuesday in March, is only for President of the United States. We would still be subject to an August primary, hopefully a June primary, but we would still be subject to the current law, which is an August primary right now. So we preserve the caucus system. We believe that it's good for local party building. We believe that it's important for local candidates to be involved, to give the grassroots to maintain their outlet and their voice in the process. But at the same time, I don't believe the current caucus system is conducive to allowing all, you know, GOP and DFL voters out there the ability to have a say in who their presidential nominee or choice should be.
And Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe Secretary Assignment could join Chair Sanders, as I do have some questions that they may need to collaborate a little bit on, just to help provide some background and clarity.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Secretary of State Simon.
Thank you.
If you could state your name for the record.
Sure. Steve Simon, Secretary of State. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And to Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Sanders and Secretary of State Simon, the question that I have, and I'm going to stipulate some of this, you have to be 18 years of age or older on the general election day in the state of Minnesota in order to cast a ballot. You also have to be 18 in a August, currently perhaps June primary, if that statute changes. One of the things that the caucus system allows is for persons who will be 18 on the next general election for president to be able to vote or cast a vote in the straw polls. It is the presidential primary that we're contemplating going to follow the rules that are currently in statute, having to be 18 on the day of, or are we going to be making a special provision to engage younger voters like we currently do in the caucus system?
Well, I would say that, yeah, Madam Chair.
Secretary of State Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative O'Driscoll. Really, that's up to you. As members may know, states have gone either way on that. And recently in the Ohio primary that just happened, there was even some litigation about whether or not that was the case under Ohio law. A judge ruled that it was. I think the statute was a little ambiguous, but really that's That's your call as legislators, whether you want to make 17-year-olds who will be 18 by the general election eligible to vote in the presidential primary.
Representative O'Driscoll, any follow-up?
I see the chair may want to say something, so I would defer if there's anything. If not, I guess I don't really have any other follow-up. I just wanted that issue to be addressed because it would be a slight deviation from what the caucuses allow right now. And I know that I was approached by a number of individuals who were going to be eligible to vote that were at my caucus, and I just was thinking about those would-be constituents and being able to vote and wanting to be involved in the voting process that they not be forgotten. And since this is information and we do have time to work on it, I just put that out there for consideration for the Secretary of State's office and for the author of the bill to contemplate with our Senate counterparts.
Thank you for bringing up that important question, Representative O'Driscoll, and to Chairman Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative O'Driscoll, I think that if you're old enough to vote in the November general election, that you also should be able to have a voice in who your nominee is. So I am open to allowing any individual that will be of voting age by the general election to also be able to participate in choosing who their nominees are, whether it be presidential primary or the general primary for other offices as well. I think if you are able to vote for an individual on the ballot, I think you should also have the right to be able to have a voice in who those names on the ballot are.
And Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is for the bill's author, Chair Sanders. Does your bill address the open versus closed primary? So would the parties be able to cross over, for instance, like some states have that set up now?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Scott, excellent question. Currently, as the bill is drafted, it is for an open primary. I will say, in talking with Secretary Simon, my preference that I stated to him and to others was to have a primary like we would normally have a primary in Minnesota, so that you walk in, you registered, you grab a ballot, and everyone's on the ballot, but you're not allowed to cross party lines, right? Otherwise, you invalidate your ballot. That was my preference, just so we have continuity throughout our primaries. In speaking with the party chairs, this is a very important issue to them for very understandable reasons. They would like to move to a more of a closed-ish primary, to where anybody can walk into the polling place and choose a Republican or a DFL ballot in Minnesota. But that would be registered. So we won't say you have to be a registered Republican or a registered member of the DFL to vote in the Republican or DFL primary. But what would be a part of the record was which ballot you chose. So it would say Representative Sanders voted in the Republican primary. That would be public information through the Secretary of State's office. And part of the thinking behind that, which I can respect, is this isn't about who Minnesota thinks should be the Democrat candidate or who Minnesota thinks should be the Republican nominee for president. This is about who do the members of Minnesota DFL think the DFL nominee should be, and who do the voters in Minnesota that are Republican think the Republican nominee should be. And both party chairs feel very firm on the position that we want to make sure that those voting in the DFL primary actually have the loudest voice in who the DFL or Democrat nominee would be. I'm sympathetic to that. I understand what they're saying. I understand where they're coming from. There also is some question whether or not RNC or DNC rules, whether or not they would accept a completely open primary versus a completely closed primary, right? So obviously the parties feel much stronger and endorse more towards the closed primaries, where they feel like it is a much more accurate reflection of the party's voice. And frankly, at the end of the day, this is This is about the parties choosing their nominee. To where my initial position on this was to say I'd like an open primary, and I don't think that it should necessarily be part of the record which ballot a Minnesotan picks. I do respect the party's positions, and that this really is the party nomination process. And as the state, we want to make sure that we facilitate and have the accessibility to all voters that wish to participate, that we can accommodate that.
Representative Scott.
Okay.
And Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. We used to have a primary system in the state of Minnesota, correct?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Representative Seltzer, would you repeat that? I'm sorry.
Certainly. We used to have a primary system similar to other states regarding nominees for the two major parties in Minnesota. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Seltzer, yes, that is correct.
And so I'm wondering why we went from that system to the caucus system, which resulted in a year of intense interest with the difficulties that we experienced this last caucus.
Chairman Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can take a stab at answering that. I won't tell you how old I was when Minnesota went through that process. But I'm happy to maybe throw it to Mr. Gehring or to Secretary of State Simon, because I think it's important to understand the history correctly.
Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, Representative Seltzer. So Minnesota last conducted a presidential primary in 1992. Prior to that, the next historic primary was in the 1950s. So 1952 and 56, the state had primaries. And then if you go back further than that, 1911 was the last state primary for the president. So really, Minnesota's history is actually more strongly on the caucus side, with these sort of sporadic experiments with presidential primary procedures. In 92, the statute was enacted to provide for the primary in that year, and then it remained in place until 1998. But the only actual primary that was conducted was in 92, and each subsequent year the legislature sort of delayed the effective date, so it didn't occur again after 1992. But really, the state's more strongly, the state's history has been more strongly on the caucus side rather than the primary side.
Secretary of State Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only thing I would add, I can't add anything to those facts, but my understanding as well is that it really wasn't until the 1970s that the national parties recognized primaries in any sort of mass way. It was much more of a smoke-filled room before that. Primaries were often symbolic. So Minnesota in the 50s stopped conducting primaries in part because the national parties didn't recognize them. And delegates weren't necessarily selected on the basis of primaries. And it wasn't, as Mr. Gehring said, until 1992. But ironically, even in 1992, it was made a non-binding so-called beauty contest. It had no bearing whatsoever on allocation of delegates. So it was an experiment that hasn't been tried since then.
Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, just a little bit of history for the 1992 primary. So actually, following that primary, the Republican Party agreed to abide by the results of the state primary in choosing their delegates to the national convention for their candidate, but the DFL party chose in 1992 to continue to use their caucus results in choosing their nominee. So there was a bit of a split depending on which party you voted for in 1992 and whether your vote actually counted towards much in terms of the primary. But in this case, it sounds like the parties have maybe taken a different position on that.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you for that history lesson. That was great. When we moved, though, we had the we had a few experiments, it sounds like, in the primary system, you know, and I'm just wondering if anyone has any history as to, you know, why that was abandoned. You said it was, and it obviously was, but I'm wondering why it was. Do we know?
Chairman Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I don't know if Mr. Gehring wants to delve into thoughts or opinions on why we did. Otherwise, maybe Secretary of State Simon has a good idea on that.
Secretary of State Simon.
You know, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Seltzer. In terms of why the 1992 experiment was abandoned after the one time, is that the question? Or
yes, what I'm trying to get at is, you know, obviously we know what the problems are with the caucus system. but we tried the primary system, and we decided that wasn't so great either. So I'm just wondering, you know, as we look at switching, which looks like a good idea to me, I have some ideas on whether it should be closed or open, but I'm just wondering if we can take any lessons from history, you know, as we again contemplate diving into the primary mode.
Secretary of State Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Seltzer. You know, I think it was a variety of things. My understanding is some people were concerned about costs, some people were concerned about whether it was binding or non-binding, some people were concerned about the effect it would have on caucuses in general, apart from the presidential campaign. I think it was a variety of factors, and the legislature throughout the 90s and early 2000s just decided not to pursue that experiment again. But that was before, of course, the massive turnouts in 2008 and in 2016, two open seat presidential elections, as Chair Sanders alluded to, which obviously inspire more turnout and activism and enthusiasm, and which is why I assume we have the bill before us.
And Mr. Gehring has something more to add.
Madam Chair, so I won't add too much of the kind of speculation about the political motivations for why you'd have a primary or not, but I can just point out that after 1992 or during the 92 process, there was pretty significant pushback from the cities and local jurisdictions about having to run an additional primary, and several cities and counties adopted resolutions opposing the idea because of the cost that would be involved and just the sort of administrative burden of running an additional election. So that was, I think, part of the discussion at the time.
Chairman Sanders, did you want to make any additional comments?
Not on that, Madam Chair. But after Representative Seltzer, I'd like to.
Okay, and Representative Seltzer.
I just want to thank the participants for this little history lesson. And it seems to me, and I'm sure we'll be discussing open versus closed primaries, what we lose when we don't just have a caucus. And I agree that the caucus system just did not work. I was there that evening, even despite the best efforts of many volunteers. So I think we have to look seriously at this, but I think we have to consider the ramifications. Thank you.
Thank you. And Chairman Sanders?
Madam Chair, at this time, I know that the Secretary has some general thoughts and questions that he would like to testify on. So if it's okay, at this point, I'd rather turn the committee over to Secretary Simon.
Absolutely. Secretary of State Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll be quick. I don't want to repeat Representative Sanders' arguments. I want to thank him, though, and Representative Garofalo for getting this discussion started in Minnesota. I think it's important. The bottom line for me is I do believe that moving to a presidential primary system while maintaining caucuses for all other elected offices is worth pursuing if it means more access and more opportunities for eligible Minnesotans to vote. As a legislator in 2007, I put in a bill much like Representative Sanders' bill to go to a presidential primary as well. And I think, we really should be doing everything we can do to make it easier for eligible Minnesotans to participate and to have their voices heard. And the caucuses are very valuable. I think many of us recognize the advantages of the caucuses. They enable outsiders, people without means, and others to really thrive in the political process and seek political office. And a lot of us in this room might not be in this room were it not for the caucus process. That said, I think in presidential years such as this, with a lot of interest and a lot of excitement and a lot of turnout, we've seen that turnout has outstripped capacity. And that's what happened in so many places in Minnesota in both of the major political parties. So the good news is that our election system in Minnesota, just from a mechanical standpoint, is really much copied and much envied throughout the country. And that is due largely because of the great work done at the local level by elections experts, by elections administrators at the county, city, and township level. They're the ones who are the spine of the system. They're the people who help run the system and do it so well and so competently. But therein lies one of the challenges here, and this is a main point I want to make, which is that a new presidential primary election would mean additional costs for counties, cities, and townships, anyone who administers an election. And I really do expect and hope that any legislative efforts to move to a presidential primary system will take that burden and expense into account at some point along the process. I will just tell you we're working on a fiscal note right now in our office. I can tell you within a range, and it's an unsatisfyingly broad range, but right now I would say we're looking at anywhere in the neighborhood of $4 to $6 million. A sliver of that cost would be attributable to our office. I mean, we don't do the sort of on-the-ground administration, obviously, the vast majority would be with counties, cities, and townships. That sliver would pertain to, as you'll see in the ultimate fiscal note, a lot of programming costs that we're going to have in our office for creating a brand new election where none existed before. But you'll see that sooner rather than later. We're working very hard on it. But I just wanted to give you sort of the heads up and the warning about the costs that will come with that. Now, the good news is it's not until 2020. And that really it's two budget cycles from now, not even the 17 session, but probably the 19 session. But be that as it may, I just think that's an important component. And as Mr. Gehring pointed out, just a matter of history, one of the reasons why the experiment of 1992 was not sustained for longer was because of complaints from the local level about some of the costs. So I think this is a great idea worth pursuing. I just hope that we do right by the counties, the cities, and the townships. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Secretary of State Simon. Those were very great remarks. We have Representative Halverson is next.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Sanders, for bringing this bill forward. This is really an important conversation. We certainly all heard a lot about accessibility on caucus night for folks. And I agree that I'm proud of the participation levels that we see in Minnesota, and we should do all that we can to make sure that Minnesotans get to have their voice heard. My first question for you would be, what is the path for this bill? I might have missed that. I know you said we're going to hear it next week to vote on, so where will it go after that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Halverson, it's my understanding right now that, or I will say my intention, that we actually be able to take this back up on Tuesday with all the appropriate language, have any further discussion we need, pass it out of this committee, I believe, to State Government Finance, where we would have the, my intention is we will have the cost built in already, hopefully, at that point in time, but if not, by the time it gets to State Government Finance, we'll be able to have those conversations. After that, that should be the only committees that actually need to have jurisdiction over it. I guess maybe depending on how the cost structure works, maybe Ways and Means. But I would assume that this would mostly be a State Government Finance issue, because we would be sending the funds to the Secretary of State's office for them to reimburse the counties at that point in time.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Sanders. It's a pretty fast path for the bill, potentially, depending on how we deal with it. And I know that you are taking lots of feedback and taking it in and trying to work with everybody's concerns, so I really appreciate that. I think that one of the concerns I would have about having a very quick path to this bill is ensuring that there's time for the public to weigh in on the closed versus open question. I have talked to lots of voters over the years, and Minnesotans really seem to value their privacy. There are lots of marriages where people don't share the political party in the state. My own dad didn't know my political party till I filed to run for office. So we have a lot of those kind of values that Minnesota voters seem to have, at least anecdotally in my history, and I would certainly like to make sure that the public would have time to weigh in on that question, because we want to do right by them, and I know that's a value you share as well. My final question for you then would be, one of the reasons that we have such high voter turnout is because of the current statutes that exist to provide accessibility to the poll, and Secretary Simon had mentioned that. So are you also looking at changes in other parts of voter law, like same-day voter registration or time off to vote, that would have to be changed if we add a presidential primary?
Chairman Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To your last question first, it's my understanding, if we run an election basically through the Secretary of State's office, that all laws on the books are in force. So the absentee ballot process, all of those are still in force. I'm happy to defer to Secretary Simon, but it's my understanding that this would be an election would be run, and all of the same rules and statutes and procedures that exist would also apply to this primary.
I see Secretary of State nodding. Would you like to add any comments?
Well said.
And Madam Chair and Representative Halverson, to your first point on open versus closed, yes. And I will say, I mean, I don't know that necessarily flies through State Government Finance super quick. I mean, we actually need the fiscal note to come back. So during that gap as well, we'll continue to seek input. And if there's time today, we can even take testimony from the public, and we'll continue to work on that. I agree with you, open versus closed. I mean, that may be maybe the highest point of contention right now in the bill, and I understand that. You know, we'll see how it works out. I mean, right now, you have to walk into a partisan high school room or a partisan gym. I mean, you know, there's some publicness to going to caucuses and caucusing for a particular party more so than a particular individual at this point. But I agree with you that will be a discussion that we continue to have and that we'll see what we can do. The parties, again, were very firm on their support, more or less being linked to the ability to control, to make sure that the parties are actually having more of a say in who their nominees are. So certainly open and willing to seeing if we can, what we can do. As I said, my intention, first off, was to have much more of an open primary as well. So we'll continue that discussion.
Representative Halverson.
Just quickly, thank you, first of all, for that, and I appreciate that. And I'll just come out and say I don't know what the right answer is on that question, and that's why the more that we have time to hear, the better. And so that's why I want us to really think about timing with regard to this. And I do just want to make sure that we caution ourselves as this does go through, if this does go through this year, to make sure that, and I know our technical folks will take a look, but I think time off to vote, there might be just a technical language change. So there might be just a few technical things that we'll need to make sure to look at to make sure that all of our laws apply to this as well. So,
thank you, Representative Halverson. And Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure exactly who I'll ask the author of this question first. I'm looking on page 6 of the bill, lines 26 through 29. And Representative Sanders, it strikes me as a bit of a contradiction that we're codifying the preference for delegates to be obligated or committed on the first ballot, but yet does that apply contrary to what both the RNC and DNC at the national level would obligate of their delegates?
Chairman Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Albright, I believe that is basically the current language as is right now. But I'm happy to ask Mr. Gehring or even Secretary Simon to weigh in on that. But I believe that is this is currently how things work.
Madam Chair, and then maybe a follow-up for Representative Sanders. Has it been the precedent in the past that the delegates themselves or the voters themselves have had that option to vote a preference, or when they enter into a primary vote, do they already know that is a binding obligation upon them? And are we inferring that they also have the opportunity to decide whether or not they're going to be obligated or committed on the first ballot only, as opposed to, it seems to be as opposed to walking into the booth knowing that, now we're allowing them to have the availability to decide their own fate in the upcoming national presidential election?
Chairman Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Albright, I will say this, that I think whether or not this language is, I'll say this, I don't know exactly if this language will be in the final product. I think what we are going to do is more so, I think as it should be, kick this part to the parties, where they determine what happens with their delegates through the first round of voting, or if their nominee releases them as delegates. I believe that's more of a party function than a state government, state law function. So I think in the final bill, it's my understanding that language should be in there that would more so leave that up to the parties.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Sanders, I think that's exactly the point that I was hoping to make, is that rather than the state legislature enact legislation that obligates either a partisan political party to that action. You leave it up to the activists themselves in terms of how they determine their fate as a delegate.
Agreed.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. And Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, just to point out some additional language that kind of goes with the section that you're looking at right now. So at the bottom of page 7, line 7.33 through page 8 on line 8.2, this is language that also binds the delegates that are chosen to vote for the candidate that they're selected to support in the first ballot, but then also includes language that provides that if the national party has rules of their convention that are different than what's provided in the state law, then those national rules supersede the state requirement. So there's still, if there's a process that's different that the party chooses at their convention, the delegates would still be obligated to follow those procedural rules.
So, Madam Chair, then the follow-up to Mr. Gehring's comments, then it would seem fairly obvious that should be left up to the national parties and not part of the legislative process that we're enacting in the law.
Thank you, Representative Albright. And Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chairman Sanders, I want to thank you for bringing up the caucus system. It really is very important to grassroots and community building. And I do like the idea of having it the week before the primary. Would that be something that you would put in statute too, so that would be binding? I just worry about that part of the system going away and how important it is for grassroots.
Chairman Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Joaquin, I think what we'll do is probably leave the language very similar to what it is currently in caucuses, in that basically, if the two major parties don't agree on a date, then maybe it would be the week before. But I still think we need to allow some latitude to the parties to choose how they want to do their business. Mm-hmm. I think that, again, caucus systems and, primaries and choosing your nominees and choosing your candidates is a party function, and I think it's our job as a state to make sure that the ground rules are open and fair and transparent, that we provide accessibility for everyone that wants to be involved to be able to be involved. But the actual function of or the mechanism of that, the parties kind of have the ultimate say. In fact, if we just said, hey, we're going to a straight primary, there's actually nothing we can do to prevent the parties from still participating in the caucus system. So I think it's important that we preserve the caucus system, which we do in the language. And I think that we can have some language that makes sure that we say, hey, unless the two parties agree, we'll have it the week before. But I don't know that we could just, in statute, say that it must be the week before. I think we need to allow some flexibility to the parties as well. But I do agree with your sentiments that we should preserve the caucus system.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Chairwoman and Chair Sanders. Thank you for that answer. Had one other question for you and then maybe one for Secretary Simon. Why the rush? We do have some time to get through this and to have more public input on, adding on to what Representative Halverson has said. It's really important when we go through the committee process that we do have public input, and I know you had mentioned having folks come up today, but really wasn't publicized for that. So just wondering why the rush to get it done this year.
Chairman Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it's a good question. And I think the importance of this is the political reality in which we all face working in state government. That when you have the momentum that this bill has, when you have leadership across the state, across our political parties, saying, hey, we all agree that we need to move in this direction, you've got to strike when the iron's hot, more or less. Governor Dayton has come out in support. Secretary Simon has mentioned his support for the concept. Both party chairs have agreed to support or have listed out what they could support to move to a presidential primary. Senator Bach has come out in support. Speaker Dowd has come out in support. That doesn't happen a lot here. So when that does happen, and look, I mean, the stark reality is, you know, things happen and we lose the emotion or we lose the perspective that we have right now, and that we need to fix what happened this last caucus night on March 1st. It's not sustainable. It wasn't good. The turnout was fantastic, right? I mean, it's just amazing. But we weren't able to, basing it solely off of volunteers, to accommodate those individuals. The problem that we get into if we say, well, let's do this in 3 years, well, by then, there's a good chance that, you know, a third of the legislature never experienced Tuesday night. You know, I mean, that's two cycles down the road. All of us in this committee, all of the members of the legislature, we dealt with the realities on that Tuesday night. So I think it's important that while we have the momentum, while we have leadership across the state, both parties agreeing that this is a move to make, I think that we have to move this session. Now, I wish we had more time, more or less, to actually really, really slow down. But with deadlines being April 1st, we don't have also that luxury to really slow down as well. So my hope is that by giving the public almost a week's notice and all of us beginning to have this conversation today in a very public forum, that we'll be able to move as smoothly as possible. Now, my intention is to get this right the first time. That's why we moved to an informational hearing. I want to line up the bill hopefully identically with the Senate so that we don't have to even go to conference committee, but we can work all of this out beforehand. I'm not opposed to that. It just would be nice to be able to have agreement with all of the stakeholders, with the public, as we move into that final push. So do I wish we had a little more time to actually slow things down this session? Yes. Do I think that we should push it off for next year or 2 years down the road or 3 years down the road? I don't think we'll have the same intensity or the same ability to have this conversation with all the stakeholders that we do right now. So I certainly understand the comments of not rushing into this, but there are times here in St. Paul when everything lines up where you got to grab it and you got to run. And it's our job to make sure that we get it right, to work closely with all of the stakeholders, to get the language with Mr. Gehring and his counterpart in the Senate, and to get everyone's feedback. This is something that I think is crucially important, but even more than that, we have to get it right. I truly am open to any thoughts or ideas and getting a product that we can get across the finish line with everyone's support. I mean, this is an election issue. It has to have, very broad bipartisan support. So that is the goal. And when we have the support that we have now, like I said, that doesn't happen too often. So when it does, you got to bottle that lightning and make it happen.
Representative Joaquin, any?
Yes. Thank you, Chairwoman, Chair Sanders. I completely understand the wanting to strike while the iron's hot. And I agree that wholeheartedly about wanting to get it done right the first time. Sometimes those two don't work in concert together. And I am really worried about not having enough public input, not having enough time to really dig into this. That being said, I agree. We should get something done this year if possible. And we all know the nature, and you're right. It is a breath of fresh air to have something that actually functions bipartisanly and people are excited about. But we also know that there's procedures for bills getting to the floor late after deadlines. I wasn't part of leadership to set the deadlines. I don't agree with them being this quickly either. But we do have options for bills to go past deadline and still make it through the process. So just a note of caution, hoping that you'd think about that. I have one quick question for Secretary Simon, and I just more of a clarifying question. First, thank you so much for mentioning the cost. Having served on local government for 9 years, it does really hit our local governments hard when we have multiple elections in a year. From my understanding, the way the bill is drafted, the Secretary of State's office would be responsible for the primary election functions, but that would still kind of carve off or wall off the functions that the party does with the caucus system. Is that correct?
Secretary of State, Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Joachim. Yes, that's right. So the caucus, the state would not be absorbing any cost, just as it doesn't now, really, for caucuses. There would be that bright line. Right. And you know, in terms of the cost, I just want to put an exclamation point on that, as everyone acknowledges. It is a big deal. It's a big cost to them. It's a new election that they haven't really had to run since 1992, and before that, since the 50s. It's in the winter. Not that that necessarily affects the cost, but, you know, we're asking them to do new stuff. They've got to recruit election judges by the thousands, all the rest. And so we just should acknowledge that. That's all.
Thank you. Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to make a comment here about this, and we agree that I really like the primary idea. I've told people, don't worry, we're not going to have to come back in 4 years and do the same thing again because we're going to pass a primary. It's bipartisanly wanted. But it's the people that we're doing it for. It's the people who we want them to have an efficient process, accessibility. We want them to have convenience. It's the people that we're doing it for, and which is emphasized by the fact that we're using state tax dollars for it. $4 to $6 million every 4 years is a cost, and as you said, the local governments would have to take care of it. And it's working through the Secretary of State's offices, which is a state function. This is the people's business, and we are setting law for the people, not for the parties. And yes, I understand the rationale of the parties and their desires, but we are writing the law for the people, and it just makes my Minnesota sensibilities cringe at the thought of the lack of privacy in a closed primary where your choice of who you, what party you voted for is public information. I know many states do that, but like I said, it just makes my Minnesota sensibilities cringe. If the parties want to do something like this, how they would use the information, that's great. But when we are doing it with state tax dollars for the people, we need to look at what the people want. And I don't think they want an open primary. I mean a closed primary. I think they want to have their privacy of their vote respected.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Lane, I understand what you're saying. And I also understand where the parties are coming from. And I'll just go back to saying that, yes, the establishment and function of elections is a state and local government issue. However, primaries are party politics. It's choosing nominees that will be on the general election ballot with a party endorsement and a party label. You know, I agree that I don't think we should change it or close the primary for the general election primary, which again is in August, hopefully in June. But as far as presidential nominees go, you know, I think that there are some valid points that the parties, the RNC, the DNC, the MNGOP, the MNDFL, they want to make sure that the voters are choosing their party's nominee. And so I understand that because up until today, the caucus, even what we did on Tuesday, March 1st, was completely and solely a party function, 100% a party function. Albeit state law says you're going to meet March 1st, everything that happened from there, Bernie Sanders winning Minnesota, Marco Rubio winning Minnesota, those are party functions. And so, you know, yes, well, it's clearly the discussion and the sticking point that we'll have moving forward, and discussions need to be made. I understand your point. That's where I started as well. But I certainly understand, I think as well, where the parties are coming from. And I think that Minnesotans as well, just as equally as wanting their privacy protected, want to have a say and want to have a voice in choosing their party's nominee. And if the RNC or the DNC do not accept or validate our elections because they don't accept a completely open primary, which they could do by rule, then again, we're at a pointless exercise. And I think Minnesotans want to count.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Lane.
I agree to a point. However, the people are coming out to vote for who they would like to see down the line for president. They're not necessarily saying, I want to participate in a particular party, although that's a reality. They're coming out thinking they're making their vote known across the nation for who they want for president, regardless of party. We separate ourselves in our job here from our party as far as anything that has to do with money and from our job. So we can certainly speak partisanly, but when we do something that has money, we are to be very, very clear that we're not using anything that has to do with state tax dollars for our personal party choices and work. And this is where it crosses the line for me, when we're putting state tax dollars on it big time at the local level all the way up, and when we're working through the Secretary of State's office for it. This crosses the line for me when we're using state tax dollars for party business.
Chairman Sesson. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I too have some concerns about the speed with which we're moving in this direction. And I'm wondering about, are there any state, I mean, I really fear that, yes, we're going to give lip service to keeping caucuses alive, but really don't see how it does anything but weaken them tremendously. And I just wonder, like Nevada, still, there's how many caucus states, maybe you know, but, you know, here's Nevada doing one on Saturday, which is a very interesting sort of, you know, twist on caucus systems. And it allows a lot of people to come out. They take their votes. I don't know all the particulars, but, you know, maybe we haven't thought about how we might adjust what we do currently, because I think there's tremendous benefits. And then if you also have some voter turnout comparisons, I mean, I don't know how many total came out here in Minnesota on the first versus, say, you know, other states that had just an open primary, but that would be interesting because people, you know, there was a significant volume. So just if you could answer a couple of those questions.
Chairman Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I don't necessarily know how to answer your first question, Representative Runbeck. I guess I don't necessarily understand what you were saying. I will just say certainly many other states have actual primaries. Many states do things differently. There are a whole host of options. Obviously, yesterday was Super, Super Tuesday or something along those lines, where many states had primaries as well. So many states have primaries. A few states have caucuses. Some folks have multiple primaries. You know, like Iowa, they have they're obviously first in the nation, but then their local elected officials have a later primary, later endorsing days as well. So, I mean, states do things differently. Nevada's a very interesting case for their primaries are not on the same day. Nevada for Republicans was a couple weeks ago. It's a Democrat primary on Saturday. So, look, states can do things differently. There is plenty of anecdotal and empirical data out there for all of us to look at. We think this hybrid approach is very good for Minnesota, very good for local politics, local grassroots, but also for mass participation of voters in choosing their party's nominee.
Representative Runbeck.
I'll say again, it seems that there should be a discussion, maybe even some focus grouping. Do we even know what a majority of people think about what happened on March 1st? To so quickly conclude that, gee, it didn't work, and we have to fix it, I think seems to be, uninformed. But let me just also ask about independent. Are we still an independent, a state that allows independent party, and would they then still be on a ballot, and they could be a part of the process as well?
Secretary of State Simon.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and Representative Runbeck. You could do it in a variety of ways. You could ensure that any and all parties within some reasonable threshold could also hold their their primary, a presidential primary, a Green Party, a Libertarian Party, any other party, or you could decide not to do that. You know, right now for our regular primary, you know, we have the 5% threshold right now for parties to attain major status and therefore be entitled automatically to a primary. Right now, though, we only have two, for the first time in quite a number of years, we only have two parties that have met that threshold, the DFL party and the Minnesota GOP.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Sanders. Mr. Secretary, first of all, I want to thank you, everybody. I want to thank you for being proactive in planning well in advance of the next presidential preference poll, because as we know, our counties and municipalities really need as much time mm-hmm. to plan ahead for election law changes. And I want to comment that in my district, not only were people turned away and couldn't find parking, but all day long, people were showing up wondering where they could vote. My district has a lot of new people to the state of Minnesota, and I would be willing to bet that a lot of you serve in many same districts where you have a lot of people moving in as well. And there are very few caucus states left, so they don't realize that we're a caucus state and not a primary state. So anytime we can make a positive impact on voter participation is really important. But I do have one question for you, and I do want to say, as we've come into the argument of caucus primary, yes, we endorse at the caucus level, at the local level, but if that endorsement ends up in a primary challenge, it is the winner of the primary that ends up on the final ballot in the end. But have you worked in with your language, have you worked with the national party leaders, or are party leaders working with the national party leaders? They have their own bylaws and rules, just as we come up with the language to make sure that we stay within those rules and with the guidelines at the national level.
Chairman Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Fenton. I have personally not yet spoken with the RNC or the DNC. I know that Chairman Downey has reached out to the RNC. We are still working with getting a face-to-face meeting with Chair Martin as well. So it is our intention that whatever we do lines up basically with what both national parties do, because again, I think it's very important that Minnesota's voters' votes count, and that we have a strong voice in each of our parties choosing who those nominees will be. So we don't want to run afoul of those. It's my understanding, at least on the RNC side as of right now, we are in total alignment, and actually they are more pro moving in this direction than they are in the caucus scenario. You know, a couple things that we currently have right now, going back to Representative Halverson's point about time off for work and those sorts of things, you know, that's really tough right now under the current caucus system. You know, if your kids are in sports or you've got work or anything, I mean, you lose your chance. You know, I mean, it's such a small window of time right now to vote and to have a say. And I think even this year, at least on the RNC side, with Minnesota kind of actually counting for the first time, I mean, the turnout was incredible. It just shows you that, you know, Minnesotans want to be heard. So we want to line up. We want to make sure that we do everything right so that our voters' voices are heard.
Thank you, Representative Fenton.
No further questions. Thank you.
Okay, and before I go to Representative Nelson, I just wanted to weigh in on the comment that Chairman Sanders made about the number of families, busy families, that were unable to participate because of, you know, kids' activities or whatever the case might be. And I think we've all experienced, I have a large number of snowbirds in my district and heard from many who would love to participate, but they're just physically not going to come back for the process. So given that this would be run through the Secretary of State's office, I'm in strong support of this. I think we would increase the participation in a process like this. So Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And when I first put my hand up, I had the question about the time off to vote. And that's already been answered, I hope, and I hope we can get some clarification on that when we do have the hearing, that because that's been a question that's been asked to me a lot of, am I going to be able to have time out to vote for the primary? I can do that now in a general election, and I know Minnesota, I don't know if Minnesota's unique in that, or, but I think, and a lot of people in the state don't understand that, that they have that time off to vote during an election, and they can't be docked by their employer because of it, and it might even increase larger our number of nation-leading vote totals that we have in our general elections. But also, as we were talking here, we were talking about registration, and not really registration, but designating who you are, what party you're going for. Last night when they were giving some of the results and talking about the primaries that went on last night, I think it was Ohio, there was some confusion there because they require 29 days before the presidential primary, you have to register as a Democrat or a Republican. And there were people showing up at the polling places that hadn't registered ahead of time, so they couldn't vote one way or the other, and there was some angst because of that and confusion, and then, or they were asking for the wrong ballot. They were registered as a Republican and they were asking for a Democratic ballot and vice versa. So I think if we're going to go to a closed style primary, as we're talking here, the way that it's been laid out in other bills that have been put forward, that the idea of doing it the night of you come in, you ask for a ballot that either Democratic or Republican, and that's recorded, is probably the preferable way of doing it than having to have pre-registered, because, you know, like this year and like 8 years ago, when you have a huge mass turnout of people, we don't want to be turning people away that didn't take the time or didn't know they had to go 29 days ahead of time and register for a party. So that's more of a comment than a question.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, I hear you. We'll make sure that the final bill addresses both those issues. It's my understanding that the bill already does address those. The current bill that I have right now does address that. It's in the definitions section where we give time off to vote. And voter registration is page 5, section 9. So we basically keep current statute. We just add the words presidential primary in there. So we, again, the processes, the statutes, the laws, rules that we have regarding elections would be enforced. Absentee ballots, again, to go back, I think the parties would basically, I think, freeze the ballots about 56 days before the election, and then absentee ballots would then go out under normal processes of the Secretary of State's office, which I think is 46 days before that primary. So it's not perfect, you know, obviously. I mean, candidates drop off and are added late during this primary. Clearly, if you vote day 42 of that process, you know, I mean, your candidate may or may not be there, but we certainly want to allow as many individuals to vote as possible. I think Representative Pugh's district is a great example of folks that if you are a snowbird or on vacation, you know, again, you don't have the opportunity to have a voice during the caucus system now, which would hopefully be another advantage of moving to a primary. Mm-hmm. But yes, we will address both of those issues to make sure that they line up with current law.
Representative Nelson? Good. Okay. Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Sanders, there's a lot of talk about disenfranchisement this year to me from a lot of my constituents about the whole caucus system, and they really have almost had it with the fact that they are, in essence, disenfranchised by the caucus system. There's so many things going on for people in my district, at least, and they're not down in wherever, as in Representative Hughes' district. They're not all down there. My district, they're working. There's a lot of things going on. And reality is that they can't get off. But do you really think that the parties are going to turn down the results from Minnesota? I mean, if I'm a Democrat, obviously, and if the Republican Party turns down the results of the Minnesota primary election, I would love that, and I would think you would. I'm sure you would love it if the Democratic Party turned down the results of the Minnesota primary election. I don't think that national parties are that stupid, because whichever one does it, they're going to lose that state in the general election, probably.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, I don't pretend for a second to try and figure out national parties and how they conduct their business. I will say, look, I mean, as much as possible, we would like to stay in line with them, so that there's the confidence by the voters that their votes will count. I hear what you're saying, and again, I kind of started there as well with my point, so duly noted. I understand what you're saying.
Okay. So, members, I don't see any other member questions. I would invite at this time any members from the public who would like to offer testimony. If you, yes, please come down, and looks like we'll have time to allow a few minutes, up to a few minutes of testimony. You just feel free to have a seat. And if you could please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Jean Massey. I'm the executive director of an organization, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization called Fair Vote Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for taking a few moments of my comments. I thought it would be helpful to share my experience representing our organization during the day and the night and the day following the caucus this year, in part because of our name, Fair Vote Minnesota, in part because we have many of our members participating in the political process because we work on election reform issues. We heard from so many people, like many of you did as representatives, about the inaccessibility of the caucus process. Some had to go home. Those with a cane could not wait in line. Those who couldn't go at 7 o'clock couldn't be there. All of the kinds of lack of access issues you've been talking about, I simply want to affirm through our own experience and thank you and applaud you for considering moving to a process that opens up the presidential preference ballot to all Minnesotans to vote on. That's very important. Our organization is really focused on ensuring that all elections are increasingly representative and have as much voter participation as possible. That's our mission. So this is a move that we support organizationally. I want to respond to one question that emerged regarding the minor parties. I think that's important. We did hear from all of the parties, as a matter of fact, on caucus night, and they all do it differently. So while the major parties experienced the crush of large lines and crowds, that wasn't necessarily the case with the minor parties, and they do it differently. Most of them do have some online voting. Some of them, the Libertarian Party actually uses a ranked ballot. So they do it differently, and it would be important to get their input in the process to make sure that the way that they conduct their primary works for them as this kind of law is put into place. So thank you for hearing my input.
Thank you, Ms. Massey, for your valuable testimony. We really appreciate it. And to the next testifier, if you could please state your name for the record.
Of course. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Scott Graham. I am the chair of Senate District 61 DFL, which is a very high volume district in southwest Minneapolis. We often lead the state in the number of caucus goers. And to Representative Runbeck's question about how not understanding how people felt, I can tell you from the ground how people felt. They were angry at caucus because they couldn't get in, and they often left unattended to, and that's an embarrassment. For the state to ask an entirely volunteer organization to basically run a primary in 90 minutes with small pieces of paper is preposterous. I strongly support the separation of the primary from the caucus, but I also strongly defend the caucus. I'm proud to participate, and I laud your efforts to maintain it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Graham, for your testimony as well. Are there any other members of the public who would like to testify? No? Okay, so to Chairman Sanders for any final remarks about the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I would just say thank you very much for the great discussion. Excellent committee work. I really appreciate it. We clearly have a lot to do. As soon as we have information on the actual bill, we will make sure that all members have that information so we can begin to work through it, talk through amendments and those sorts of issues. Want to thank Secretary Simon for giving up so much of his day to be here with us as well. And then thank my son, Everett, who is here today. I mean, he lasted longer than I did in most committees, so kudos. With that, thank you, members. We'll continue to work on this. Please let myself or Amanda know if you have any questions, comments, amendments. I know it's a tight time, but we want to make sure we get it and get it done right.
Well, thank you, Chairman Sanders and members, and I just wanted to remind everybody that this is an informational hearing with regard to this bill and that there won't be any action today. So, and with that, the committee is adjourned.